Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Where do you turn for advice on your health, your finances, and your most important decisions? There is no shortage of experts in America today, and their frequent pronouncements on how we should all be doing things generate vast amounts of media attention. But do they know what they're talking about? How can it be that educational television is both very bad and very good for kids' development, or that sunscreen both protects us from and makes us vulnerable to cancer? And when so much of this week's expert advice seems to contradict the advice given last week, how should we decide what to listen to and what to ignore? David H. Friedman is a science and business journalist and contributing editor to Inc. magazine. His new book is called Wrong: Why Experts Keep Failing Us and How to Know When Not to Trust Them. Dave, welcome back to Think.
Thanks very much.
You got started thinking about this when you were researching your last book, and we talked about that on this show a couple of years ago. The subject there was the benefits of moderate disorder over rigorous organization. Talk about the interactions you had with experts on that project.
Well, it was really surprising to me that in going out and speaking to really hundreds of people who pretty much devote their professional lives to thinking about disorganization and mess, that I couldn't find a single one that had ever thought about the possibility that there are times when it's pretty good to be messy. It may actually not be such a great thing to be organized. That was sort of shocking to me because it turns out to be really easy to prove that in some cases disorganization works better. And that sort of got me thinking, well, I mean, if all the experts in this field have sort of missed the boat on this, what about in some other fields? And I started to look into it, and what I found in pretty much every field was shocking. Experts tend to get stuff wrong.
Your dad was a research chemical for Dow when you were growing up. Can you talk about how he influenced your view of the fallibility of experts?
Well, my father was an organic chemist, an industrial chemist, but essentially worked almost as an academic. And I used to visit him at the laboratory, and his office was fairly bare, except he had one framed thing on his wall. And when I was old enough to read what it was, I saw that it was a journal article. And in fact, it turned out it was a letter to the editor pointing out a big mistake he had made in his paper. And he had framed the letter and put it on his wall. And I asked him what he was doing with such an embarrassing thing on his wall. And he said, well, it reminds me how easy it is to make a mistake, to be wrong. And that sort of burrowed into my subconscious, and I think it sort of fermented there for decades and sort of came out when I was working on this project.
Well, that sort of humility is really admirable, but aren't scientists in general trained to eliminate their own biases and try to, you know, ask 25 people if they've made a mistake?
Yes and no. They are formally trained, of course, that it's critical to not be biased and to go into any sort of experiment or study without hoping for one result or another, because it's been known going back to the time of Sir Francis Bacon centuries ago that if you have a bias, you're going to not get a good result. The bias will win out in the end, unless you happen to be lucky to have the right bias, which is another question. But it turns out that scientists quickly learn as they're getting their PhD that if they get certain kinds of results, they're much more likely to get published than other kinds of results. Breakthrough findings, useful findings, positive findings where their theories work out. And so these biases become deeply ingrained in scientists, and they're very aware of it. I mean, this is a big problem in the field, and the biases end up influencing their answers, and it's a big reason we have so many studies that come to the wrong conclusion.
So those biases can happen even if they don't feel like they're deliberately lying or fabricating information?
Well, I think the vast majority of scientists do not deliberately fabricate. It's unconscious. However, part of the problem is there's a lot of room for measurement error in science. There are a lot of questions. How do you set up an experiment? What question do you ask? What do you measure? How do you interpret the results? Which data do you keep and which do you throw out because it's not relevant or it's not good for some reason? And in doing all these things, which are perfectly legitimate, there's lots of room to decide to go one way or the other. If you didn't have a bias, these sorts of errors would tend to cancel out. But if you have a bias, they're all going to sort of add up and push you towards the error that you're unconsciously hoping for.
Yeah, this made me think a lot about the idea of throwing out irrelevant information, because there could be a lot contained within that that ends up not even really making it to whatever's published.
It's a really big problem. I mean, let's consider drug studies, where, of course, these can be matters of life and death. It happens all the time in any study. You have patients who, for example, admit that they didn't really follow the drug course that they were supposed to follow, or it turns out that some technician gave out the wrong drug to certain patients. I mean, that, believe it or not, that happens too. So there are always situations where it does sort of make sense to throw out some data. There's nothing wrong with that. The problem comes in when you're deciding to keep the data that does the result you want the most good. And that's what tends to creep into a lot of studies and causes all the problem.
So, Dave, how does the peer review process fail to catch these mistakes?
Interestingly, most scientists say that the peer review process isn't even really designed to catch these errors. For example, the peer review process does not look for fraud in most cases. People are not thinking, gee, is this guy making this stuff up? What they're looking for are obvious errors, which does often catch those sorts of obvious errors, the way someone caught my father's error. But they're not typically, the people who are reviewing other scientists' work are not really going over all the calculations. They're not going to the laboratory or interviewing people who were in the study. I mean, they're not taking a close look at what was really going on. They have no way of catching most of these problems. They're really only going to catch the most obvious ones. And in fact, studies of studies have shown that they tend to not even catch some of the obvious errors. A British Medical Journal did a study and found that its peer reviewers failed to catch most errors that it slipped into a test paper. So peer review is a very, very poor defense against these sorts of problems.
So how do people who study studies and the potential problems there ever, given their field, validate their own results?
This is a huge problem. It's a very big question that sort of hangs over the whole effort. If we're going to start with the point of view that studies have a lot of problems, well then when you do studies on studies, then apparently you have problems too. And one thing I say about this is, look, if you're someone who studies studies, you better have a good idea of what some of the problems are. And you're also, you can assume your work is going to be picked on by other people in this same field who are very, very good at finding these sorts of problems. So I would make the argument that people who do this sort of thing, people who study studies, actually do manage to avoid a lot of these problems to a much greater extent than the average researcher does. And, of course, I have to include myself in that group as well. I'm not a PhD, I'm not a scientist, but I am studying studies, so I've got the same problem too.
Well, and this will not surprise you that on this show we interview people who are considered experts every day of the week, not with the intention of promoting anyone's ideas, but to understand how and what they think. We definitely give them a platform. Talk for a minute about how the media play into the dissemination of facts that turn out to be faulty.
Well, of course, the media plays a critical role. We're the ones who get the words of expertise out there, and that's important. We have to do that. The problem starts to creep in when we ask the question, well, which experts do we choose? And of course, as journalists, we're looking for people often who have the great soundbite, who have the exciting results, who may be already popular in the media for some of these reasons. And so we tend to be very biased towards experts who are willing to give us sort of simplistic answers, exciting answers, breakthrough stuff. And you can show very, very easily, and many researchers have shown, that this stuff is the stuff that's most likely to be wrong, the stuff that we most want to hear, that's dramatic, that seems incredibly helpful, that seems very certain. And those are what make for great sound bites. And we in the media are very biased towards that stuff. So in a way, we sort of make sure that the very worst of expertise is what gets transmitted to the public.
And obviously the big concern there is that once bad information gets out, especially if it's in every publication and on every place on the dial, it's really hard to put that back into the bag.
not only is that true in the mass media, where it's obviously true, a story, sometimes terrible expert advice, stuff that's really bad and potentially dangerous, gets put all over the place. And how are you going to undo that, even when the correct results end up being known perhaps a few years later, as is typically the case? Who's going to do a big story on never mind? But not only is it a problem there, it's a problem actually in research, where studies have shown that when a bad result gets cited by a lot of researchers, when the correct result is made known sometime later, the bad results continue to be cited year after year after year, and often continue to dominate the field, even though it's been proven they're bad results.
Because somebody doing a search for something may not find that one study that disproved it.
That's right. I mean, it's hard to say exactly what's going on there, but clearly it is. But yes, they may simply stop. You know, a very big question is, when you're researching a question, when do you stop looking? And often people will stop looking when they get the answer they want. They won't look any further. So yeah, so the good results often get buried, and the bad results, once again, tend to float to the top.
Talk for a minute about, did you have any concern that in taking on this project and in doing this work, you would sort of give credence to people who say, well, I can't trust any of the experts out there, and so I'll go to this crazy conspiracy theory, or I'll stop trusting anybody with a scientific background, and I'll just go to this sort of guru figure that I found?
Well, that was my biggest concern, and it's still a concern, and in fact, it's happening. Of course, these days you get to see easily who's quoting your book, who's pointing it out, and some of I've won some fans out there who are kind of anti-science and anti-expert, and claim that I validate their beliefs that scientists and people in academics don't know what they're talking about. Well, I'm really not saying that. I'm really not. And I caution very strongly in the book, for a lot of reasons, that we really should not be just rejecting in a blanket way what experts say. That's dangerous. That's reckless. There's some great advice out there. And what I'm hoping people will do is learn something about how to search out better expert advice, not reject it. I don't want to be someone who's seen as justifying those people who say, well, maybe smoking isn't so bad for you after all, and why should we wear seatbelts? I mean, that's good advice. We don't want to be rejecting that stuff.
Talk for a minute about this. You mentioned earlier that simplistic advice makes it through to the media, and that's a concern. Universal, anything that is said to be universally good for everybody is probably not true.
Well, look, the crux of the matter here is that we live in a complex world, and the most complex problems in our complex world are the ones that we want to palm off to experts. If the problems weren't really complex, really difficult, we wouldn't need experts. We'd solve them all ourselves. So what happens is experts tackle these very, very complex problems, and if they're going to come up with a right answer, it's probably going to be very customizable to different situations and different people. There's going to be a lot of uncertainty. A correct answer is going to, very, very roughly speaking, take the form of, in certain situations, there's a pretty good probability that for certain types of people, it'll be true that sometimes, et cetera, et cetera. Now, of course, that doesn't make for a very exciting quote in a newspaper article. So those experts who give these sorts of correct answers tend to get buried. And instead, we look for someone who says, well, what you want to do is eat low carbs. Well, that sounds great. Sounds like a great solution. They're the ones who get all the attention. That's the stuff that tends to be wrong.
David H. Friedman is my guest. He's a science and business journalist and a contributing editor to Inc. magazine. His new book is called Wrong: Why Experts Keep Failing Us and How to Know When Not to Trust Them. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your intellectual curiosity and design a curriculum tailored to your personal or professional interests. And you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David H. Friedman. He is a science and business journalist and contributing editor to Inc. magazine. His new book is called Wrong: Why Experts Keep Failing Us and How to Know When Not to Trust Them. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. In your book, Dave, the wisdom of crowds is articulated as the idiocy of crowds. Why are we worse off in a group thinking situation than individually?
Well, there certainly are situations where groups can do a better job than the individual. But in fact, going back for decades, it's one of the best understood problems actually in the social sciences, that groups tend to mess things up. And there are a lot of reasons for that. I mean, for one thing, if you take a group of people, then a lot of the people sitting in the group will sort of let the group carry the day, and they won't work as hard as they would if they were working separately on their own. So the output often is simply less. But in addition to that, I mean, think of what it's like to be in a group of people that are arguing about stuff. Who tends to dominate these things? Whose opinion tends to hold sway? Often, it's not the person who is the smartest or has the best answer. It's often the person who's the biggest bully, the most dominant, the most charismatic, the person who's willing to go on and on and on and sort of wear everyone else down. It might be the most manipulative person. And it's so rightness actually tends to not win out in groups. It often brings out the worst in people, and it does not tend to bring right answers to the top. And this has been shown again and again in many, many studies.
So what does that say about all these internet sites that offer answers to any problem you have?
Well, I think there's a lot of great stuff out on the internet. In fact, in most cases, I think the right answer is out there somewhere. The problem is it tends to really get outweighed by the junk. It's great that anybody can post anything online, and people, of course, take advantage of that. And the result is we've got a lot of people who really don't know what they're talking about, putting a lot of stuff out there in the most certain terms possible. And so I think if someone is willing to really go out there, do a lot of searching, be very, very fussy about what they believe, really hunt down that right answer, they can do it. On the other hand, if they're just going to do a Google search and look at the first 10 results to come out, I think they're really in bad shape. And in that sense, I think the internet tends to make things much worse.
Yeah, I had this exact experience. My 10-year-old came home from school one day and said, the kids in my class are saying that blood is blue when it's inside the body, which I know is not true. And I told him that. And I said, well, let's check it out on the internet. And it took, I have 20 years of experience in journalism. It took me about an hour to find a place where I could find the right answer because all the other sites with people out there giving their opinions were wrong.
The worst sort of advice, the stuff that's really wrong, and that's the biggest problem, typically is a problem because so many people believe it. So if you're just going to measure number of references, generally the stuff that gets the most references is going to be the most problematic stuff in many cases, on trickier problems like that one where there is a misconception. So the internet can be a terrible place to clear up this sort of thing. Now, you obviously were able to hunt down the right answer. But it took you a long time, and that's really typical. I find that happening to me all the time, too. I generally come up with very satisfying results on the internet, and I rarely end up with what turns out to be a terribly wrong answer, but it takes me a long time to do it, and I'm very practiced at it.
David H. Friedman is my guest. His new book is called Wrong. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go on the phones to Patrick in Richardson. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, I just want to tell you, great show.
Thanks.
Again, and your associate producer, Betsy, is just awesome and a great person, too.
She sure is.
My question is, it's funny you brought up, like, when you're in a group, like, who tends to dominate? And I don't understand the dynamics of it all that well either, but I would dare say that it's virtue which backs up character, which, like, basically trumps all of the cards for all of their motivations. But my question is this. National Geographic did a special on a guy named Heinrich Schroeder, who was a Bell Labs savant mathematician in solid-state physics and mathematics, and he basically forged his data on something that would have overturned Moore's law. And because he was on the cutting edge of this field of mathematics and solid-state physics, it's almost like no one else could just even, like, do the fundamentals to even check his math. And a lot of times, if you go back to this mortgage debacle, it has to do with, for a long time, about 10 years, people have been coming out with mathematics degrees to get into Wharton, and these things called quants and algorithms and these things that are very secretive, people should go back and just understand that there is a guy at Columbia who is a physicist and he's Japanese, but he said that he went back and he studied Einstein not being able to find the theory of unifying everything, because he went back and he saw how he couldn't figure out equations. Like he came to dead ends. And this is Einstein.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, Patrick.
Sorry about that. No,
I think we got your point, and I think that's an interesting point. David, a lot of times we're trying to assess information when we may not have the knowledge to know whether it's any good or not.
Well, in the case of us trying to assess what's going on out there, I mean, the whole point is we don't have the knowledge. I mean, that's when we turn to experts, of course. If we knew it, then we'd be able to disregard what the experts said. So there were really two different points here. One, of course, the first point that Patrick brought up was the that great forgery at Bell Labs. And that was one of the worst cases of science fraud ever. And what often happens in those cases, it's not true that there's no one out there that can check their people's stuff. If a researcher comes out with stuff that seems to be over everyone's head, that's a whole other problem. That rarely happens. I mean, this was a case where the guy came out with stuff that looked really good. It was a very exciting result. It had a lot of applications. It sort of changed the field in a very exciting way, and it seemed plausible. And people did understand it. They just failed to really try to validate it, which is another big misconception, that scientists are always validating each other's work. It's not true. Only a tiny percentage is, and those who do actually validate it, if they don't get the right answer, they don't publish and say, hey, wait a minute, something's going on here. What they do is they say, well, we must have screwed it up. And journals don't like to publish that sort of thing. So this guy went on for a long time, published many papers in the leading journals in the world, and no one called him on it for a long time. Now, the other problem is, I mean, someone like Einstein, is anyone smart enough to really double-check his work? Well, I think that does happen sometimes, and we did see it on Wall Street with the quants. I mean, but the thing is, the quants themselves didn't really understand their own work, and many of them said so, that we're not totally sure what's going on here. It was unexplored territory. And if you say that it's unexplored territory, then there shouldn't really be a problem as long as that gets communicated. And, of course, by the time it made its way, that advice made its way from the quants to us who are actually taking out mortgages, all that uncertainty got lost, and it sounded like a sure thing. So often the biggest problem is the losing of the caution about uncertainty. And if we were better about that, we would do much better at avoiding some of these very harmful traps.
And when a study comes out that does have a lot of those qualifying statements and sort of blunt assessments of where things don't quite add up, it's unlikely that we'll ever hear about it. Is that right?
Exactly. I mean, if the result itself is sort of wishy-washy, inconclusive, which really good studies actually come to exactly that point, you'd almost really expect them to. You're probably not going to get it published. There are some exceptions, but in general, what journals want to see is somebody proved something worked. Now, in terms of the mass media, it's a much, much bigger problem. What journalist is going to write a story that quotes some exciting result from an expert and then spends a lot of time in the article saying, by the way, most results like this turn out to be wrong. This study has all kinds of problems, and in the end, it will probably be proven wrong, too. But it sure is fun to think about it anyway. I mean, who's going to publish a story like that? What editor is even going to let that get through? And if it does somehow, who's going to read it? So we really are in kind of a tight jam here in trying, in this tension between what makes a good read, what sounds useful, and what's likely to be right.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the line to Ronnie in Fort Worth. Hey, Ronnie.
Hi. Hey, I just wanted to ask a question. What about mistrust? You know, what does that do to this whole genre we're talking about here? And what I mean by, I guess the example I would use is, you know, our own government. I think after 9/11, we had to go and kick somebody's butt because it just had to be done. But at the same time, you know, our government it seemed like it got bigger and bigger, and the stories got bigger and bigger, and one thing led to another. And now here we are in a war that, you know, two wars on two fronts for going on 10 years now, and we're still no closer to really kicking the butts of the people that originally caused all of this. And I'm just wondering, you know, what about mistrust? Where does that go? Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for your call.
This whole question of trust can be a really large one. Now, I'm not sure, Ronnie, if you're talking about the fact that we mistrust the government. Do you think that's what he was asking, Chris?
I'm thinking, yeah, or what we should do with that mistrust, I guess.
Yes. I think mistrust is actually a good thing to a certain extent. And I think the problem is people tend to fall into two camps on this question of who we trust, and that can include government experts as well. One is being too trusting, and you get caught up in the latest pronouncement from an expert, and we trust it, and we probably shouldn't. And of course, the other camp is, well, I give up. I've been kind of messed up again and again by experts. I see them, they've gone wrong again and again, so I'm not going to trust any of them. And I think you see a relatively small percentage of people actually hitting that sweet spot, which is to have a fairly high level of mistrust for the exciting breakthrough definite stuff, but yet you still have some sense that there is some good advice out there, and you're going to be wary about it, and you're going to be smart about it. And I think for people who do that, they have a much better shot at getting really good expert advice and really profiting from it, really benefiting from it, even saving their lives in the case of health care. And of course, that's what I'm hoping to do in this book, is provoke that sort of thinking and awareness, not turn people off to experts.
One thing that struck me in the book was that you noted that you should be more likely to trust a study that tells you something isn't true. For example, coffee doesn't prevent cancer.
That's right. And there's really a real simple reason for why that is, which is that generally those kinds of results are not published as often. And when they are published, it's usually because there's something really clear about it, that it's more clearly right than most other studies are, because we don't like to read as much that this stuff doesn't work. It doesn't seem as useful or exciting or dramatic to us. So when that stuff makes it through to the public, it's usually because it's a very, very good study. It's a good conclusion. And so in general, it does tend to be right, or just statistically speaking.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Andrew in Dallas. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, how's it going today?
Great, thank you.
Okay, I heard somewhere one time that 57% of all statistics are made up. And I was just curious, specifically speaking about the Internet, is there any way that you can kind of filter results or verify the authenticity of statistical data that you find?
Is there a truth bar on Google?
What a great question. Yeah, if only there were. Well, it's a great question, Andrew. And the fact of the matter is, there's some great technology that a lot of companies and researchers are working on right now that actually I think someday may go a long way towards helping bring better stuff to the top. And we don't see that stuff yet. Google has none of it. Google does nothing to separate out stuff more likely to be right from stuff more likely to be wrong. No public search engine does. So I think we're pretty stuck right now in having absolutely no external indicators for telling us what's good advice, what's a correct statistic, what's just made up. There's a tremendous amount of fraudulent and just silly and plain wrong stuff on the Internet, and I think we have to build up our own sense of how it works, and more than anything, we have to be willing to put the time and effort into it. We've got to do our homework, and of course, one of the reasons we like to listen to experts is so we don't have to work that hard. We'll let them do the hard work for us, but it turns out we have to do some hard work ourselves in figuring out which experts are more likely to be right.
And you make the point that, and we touched on this a little bit earlier, but experts are more likely to be rewarded simply for being very articulate and being able to seem authoritative than necessarily being proven right down the line.
Well, what mechanism is even in place that would allow us to go back and see which experts are right the most often? I mean, you can go back and look up their papers, but it would actually be a lot of work to look up a bunch of papers from a researcher and then track down everyone to see what papers went on to say on that subject. I mean, you can do it, but what a phenomenal amount of work. So there's no rightness score for these folks. And what it comes down to when a lot of us are trying to assess whether we believe an expert or not is just, first of all, do we like what they're saying? Do we like the kind of advice? And secondly, yeah, how does the researcher, him or herself, present to us? And there are some people who just present so well as experts. I like to use the example of Dr. Richard Ferber, the sleep expert. I saw him talk. He's wonderful. I mean, I was ready to believe absolutely everything he said. And I think he's a very good researcher. But I think a lot of his advice has really been off the mark. And, in fact, he's flip-flopped himself on a lot of his critical advice about how to get kids to sleep through the night. So, this question of a researcher's authoritativeness and charisma is an enormous one, especially in terms of the mass media.
And you mentioned that when there is new information that really resonates with us, that's when we need to look most critically at that advice that makes perfect sense. Is that as challenging for you as it is for everybody else?
Yeah, you bet it is. Absolutely. I fall prey to the same problems as everyone else. I mean, I'm probably a little more ornery, partly because that's been my style as a journalist. And I think a lot of journalists are like that. We're always looking for the everything you thought was true is wrong kind of thinking. But still, yes, look, I fall prey to this stuff all the time. And some stuff really, really, truly resonates with me. We often go out and look for experts who tell us exactly what we believe anyway. We're typically not looking for someone to contradict what we believe in life, unless, of course, it's something that we love hearing. So, you know, if we're afraid that the market's going down, we love hearing an expert who tells us it's going to go up and things are going to get better. So we tend to reward experts for the wrong things.
David H. Friedman is my guest. His new book is called Wrong, Why Experts Keep Failing Us and How to Know When Not to Trust Them. You can send email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your intellectual curiosity and design a curriculum tailored to your personal or professional interests. And you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're here this hour with David H. Friedman. He's a science and business journalist whose new book is called Wrong, Why Experts Keep Failing Us and How to Know When Not to Trust Them. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Paul in Terrell writes, a discouraging amount of what appears to be scientific information is the product of corporate PR and marketing. The studies they cite are designed to prove a desired result and are not published if they don't. Would you talk about that?
It's a huge problem. Now, first of all, my father was an industrial scientist, so I certainly wouldn't make the blanket statement that industrial scientists are all corrupt. And further blurring the line is the fact that many academic scientists, possibly most, are in fact funded to one extent or another by private industry. So the line blurs between who's in and who's out of industry. But the fact of the matter is many, many studies have shown, and this has just been documented really beyond argument, that that results do get corrupted by money from corporations. And a very big part of the problem is just, as that email note said, that when a drug company, for example, gets a result that it doesn't like in a study, it would prefer to not publish it. Now, steps are being taken by the medical community to avoid that problem. A lot of journals will only publish a study if the study was registered at the beginning of the study before the results were known, so that the results will become public whether the company likes the results or not. So that problem is getting a little bit better, but it's a huge one that haunts certainly healthcare and I think many other fields as well.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Ed in Arlington. Hello, Ed.
Hi, Chris. Another fine show.
Thank you.
My concern, I'm getting kind of kind of annoyed at what I'm hearing, because we spend not nearly as much as we should, in my opinion, but we do spend billions every year of our tax money on scientific research through the National Science Foundation, National Institute of Health, and some other entities. And what I'm hearing is that the results of those studies are basically scattered to the wind, and it's up to the individual who wants an answer to a particular problem that happens to pop into their head on a particular day to sift through random stacks of research and find the answer. Shouldn't one of the things we get for our money be a compendium of the research that our tax money pays for and an analysis of it in terms of what conclusions the research on the whole supports, what it doesn't support? This sounds very random, and it sounds to me like science is on the skids in this country, and we need to do something about it. We need to get much more rigorous and methodical about collecting its results, cataloging it, and making it available readily.
Well, I guess the question there, Ed, would be whether or not, and Dave, whether or not the people who put together that compendium would be sort of above reproach in terms of deciding what was real and what wasn't.
Exactly. And the scientific community really does not like it when anyone who is not part of the scientific community comes in and tries to do any kind of sifting or filtering or restricting or pushing in any way, shape, or form. The scientific community wants to police itself and present its results in its own way. And there's a centuries-long tradition in how it does that. But clearly, there are problems with the system. Scientists are very aware of this, by the way. Very few scientists take objection to what I say, assuming they understand what I say. So who is going to actually do this compendium? Now, many scientists do what are called meta-studies. They're studies of studies where they'll pull many, many studies together, sometimes studies done over many, many years, and they'll try to sort of pull all that data together, sometimes correct it to a certain extent, look for problems, throw out bad studies, and then come out with a result that takes all this into consideration. And these studies tend to do a better job. They still sometimes come to the wrong conclusion, but much less frequently than individual studies. So some of that really is happening. But I'd also like to say that it's not as if science is broken. It's not as if scientists are doing a terrible job. In fact, scientists are tackling these very tough problems that don't have simple answers. We should expect them to be wrong. The problem is we need to be told that when we're hearing the results. And so if we understood and accepted and even embraced a lot of the uncertainty that we get with these results, we wouldn't really have nearly as big a problem, and scientists could go about their job, and we wouldn't get misled.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Barbara in Grapevine. Hello, Barbara.
Hello. In listening to this, I'm thinking about a case in point of people insisting on the wrong results, even when contrary information comes out. Case in point, autism and vaccines. I have friends that have autistic children, and they just insist on sticking to this no matter what study comes out afterwards.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And in fact, the Lancet, the British medical journal that published that in the first place, fully retracted that initial study that got a lot of people thinking about the correlation. What do you think about that, Dave?
Well, I think there are a lot of people, possibly a majority of the people in America, who actually are going to believe what they're going to believe regardless of the evidence. They don't really decide based on the evidence. They may not have a lot of respect for scientific studies. They may not understand the difference between a scientific study, or they may just have some very strong personal bias. Certainly it's a complex situation with the parents of an autistic child who would so desperately like to think there's some sort of cure, and in some cases it would be satisfying just to know there's someone or something to blame. And of course, there really isn't. Science has shown that there isn't, not that we know of at this point. And there's almost nothing I could say to those people. I really, in my book, I sort of excuse them right at the beginning. I mean, if you're not going to be looking at the evidence, if you're going to believe what you want to believe, regardless of what, there's probably nothing I or anyone else can say to you. And I think we have to focus our attention more on those people who are willing to weigh evidence but get misled anyway. And that's a problem I think we can do a much better job of fixing.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Lane in Dallas. Hi, Lane.
Hi, Chris. Great show.
Thanks.
I had a question about, you know, Mr. Friedman was talking about the internet, and I wondered if he had any thoughts about Wikipedia and it, quote-unquote, being an expert, and whether it does a good job of managing these things we talk about, and that's all I had.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I think it's a good question, and let me start off by saying I use Wikipedia all the time.
I do too.
And the vast majority of the time, I find it useful, and I rarely end up figuring out that something Wikipedia told me is wrong. Now, of course, that may just be because I'm not realizing I may be too trusting of Wikipedia. So I think that Wikipedia is way above average. I think they've got a pretty good system going, especially if you're looking at Wikipedia pages that deal with subjects that a lot of people are contributing to. Then I think you're going to see a lot of people who are actively trying to do a good job of policing it. When you start to get to some of the fringe pages, a page that might describe a lesser-known figure or principle, then you can start to run into trouble. But I think Wikipedia does a pretty good job, and it's been shown it does about as good a job as a traditional encyclopedia. So there you go. It's a useful resource. But let me point out, Wikipedia doesn't try to give expert advice. It simply tries to accurately portray what experts are actually saying. So when there's a controversy or a problem, Wikipedia won't try to tell you which one is likely to be right. So it doesn't really address the problem we're talking about. But I have to say, in general, Wikipedia does a pretty good job of at least getting the information out there, and then you can decide from different clear points of view.
Let's go next to Jeff in Plano. Hello, Jeff.
Yes, great show. I'm wondering, just recently I heard an economist come on and say about how, you know, the we've got another 10 years of really up and down recessions, which we'll never really escape from, and it's baked in the cake, he kept saying over and over. And I'm like, what? Why isn't there a clearinghouse? I mean, maybe this is a media, maybe I'm pushing this on the media, but they are the one who are presenting these opinions or bringing these people on the show. Is there any way of a kind of clearinghouse for opinions? You know, when someone comes out and gives a strong opinion or has been brought out for that reason, an expert, you know, record it and then check against it later on in time and maybe run a tally as to who is a valid expert and who isn't, as a way of trying to clear those who claim to be experts.
So let's start keeping score. I mean, let's track what experts say, and then later on we could publish a scoreboard of which experts said what. Now, within financial advice, you actually do have scoreboards, and it turns out it doesn't solve the problem. In fact, it can actually make things worse, and here's why. You run into a couple of sort of statistical phenomena that mess you up. One is, if you want to go back, for example, in our financial crisis, you can go back and say, well, who actually had been warning all along that we were going to have a real estate crash, that we had real problems here? And you can find people who do that, and these people all of a sudden became real popular. The problem is some of them had been saying it for decades, when in fact there wasn't a problem. In other words, it's the broken clock is right twice a day. If you've got someone who goes out there and gives the same bad advice over and over again, they're eventually going to be right. Is that someone we want to trust? Now, also, in any situation, you can always go back. And so even if financial advisors or economists were just flipping coins to give their answers, you're going to find someone, the law of odds says, someone out there is going to, by luck, get it right over and over and over and over again. So if you go back and find that person, it'll look as if you've got a genius who's always right. But you don't. You have somebody who got lucky. And so we have to be really, really careful about the way we keep score. No matter how you look at it, it turns out there's just no easy way out of this problem.
And I guess there's also the problem of studies that may be sort of right in terms of their facts but come to the wrong conclusion. My favorite example is a study years ago that said babies who have nightlights on in their rooms when they're kids are more likely to grow up and need glasses. Well, then a few years later, somebody said that's true, but that's because the majority of nearsighted parents are more likely to use a nightlight than parents who aren't nearsighted, and the correlation might in fact have been genetic.
That's right, and you see that all the time. And so problems like this creep into every single stage of a study. There are many stages in a study. There are many opportunities to get it wrong, and it turns out that error creeps in at every single stage from, well, what study do we want to do? What question do we want to ask here? Errors creep in there, and all the way through to gathering the data, measuring the data, analyzing the data, and then finally presenting it and publishing it and then getting it out to the mass media. At every single stage, there are errors. And as I said, if there weren't biases, a lot of these errors would cancel out. But in fact, there is bias, so it does tend to push in the direction of error, and that's where the big problem really creeps in.
I know this is a question that you get asked in every single interview, but why should we believe you?
Well, what I say is you shouldn't. In fact, it would be depressing if after saying this kind of stuff, someone thought, well, here's an expert we can trust. No. Please don't trust me. And my point isn't really to convince anybody of everything. I'm not making some claim that I want everyone to believe. What I really want to do is just get people thinking about this. Because I think it's something most of us don't think about. We certainly don't think about enough, or we think about it simplistically, as in rejecting all expert advice. So the point I'm trying to get across is this is hard. This is a problem. Let's learn to do our homework. Let's think about this. Let's be smarter about this, and we can get some good expert advice. That's a claim I'm very, very comfortable making. If someone thinks I'm wrong even in saying that, well, so be it. Maybe I am, but I feel pretty good. I think that's not a terribly challenging claim to make.
Does this project simply sort of articulate how you feel about how you as a journalist should approach your work, or has it in fact changed the way you feel about what you do for a living?
It has quite a bit, actually. It's changed me in many ways, both as a consumer of advice, as someone, of course, who cares about what my doctor says and health care and what I invest in, and especially as a journalist. It has made me want to be much, much more careful about this stuff. Now, of course, the problem I have now is editors don't, of course, always want a journalist who's being real careful, who's rejecting expert advice or talking a lot about uncertainty or conflict. Of course, we still want those same easy, definite answers. We want those sound bites. We want that charismatic expert. So this is a problem I have to face in the projects coming at me.
It also takes more time to do it this way, to do it your way.
It certainly can, yes, and it does, and you move more slowly. And this was a big problem with this book. I mean, as the more I got into it, the more careful I wanted to be, and I realized at some point, you know, this could be an endless project. I mean, even in this book, I had to cut things off research-wise much earlier than I wanted to, and there were a lot of answers I don't feel satisfied at having gone far enough with. So, yeah, it really haunts me.
David H. Friedman is a science and business journalist. His new book is called Wrong: Why Experts Keep Failing Us and How to Know When Not to Trust Them. Dave, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Oh, it was great. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.